This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, KenaiSoul.na. This is the Kenai Conversation. I'm your host, Sabine Pooks. Companies have been dreaming about turning Cook Inlet's tides into energy for years. The inlet has the largest tides in the country and some of the largest in the world. Tidal technology is still a ways out, but some companies believe they're finally getting close. And this summer, the National Renewable Energy Laboratory is doing a study on Cook Inlet's tides to learn more about what the resource looks like and how it can best be harnessed. Homer's Levi Kilcher is working on that study. He spoke to us for this week's Kenai Conversation about it and the current state of tidal energy in the inlet. Here's our conversation with Levi, recorded Monday, June 14th.
NREL is based in Golden, Colorado, but I grew up here in Alaska, and I'm really excited to be up here talking about tidal energy today.
Are you part of a team of employees that works in Alaska, or are you kind of a one-off here?
I'm a part of the water power team at NREL, and within the water power team, I lead the resource characterization portfolio of work for the U.S. Department of Energy's Water Power Technologies Office.
Resource characterization. Can you break that down for us?
Yeah, so it's resource characterization for wave and tidal energy. So I look at where are locations in the United States where we have the most promising wave and tidal energy spots. We also look at other types of marine resources, such as ocean thermal energy and ocean current energy. That typically is the Gulf Stream, so that's off in the U.S. That's the Gulf Stream, so that's off of Florida and Georgia in the southeastern United States. And so we look at where the resources are. We quantify the total resource for the country for each of these different resource types. And then DOE uses that to make, you know, decisions on what types of projects or sites they want to look at and what types of technologies they want to invest in.
So you kind of provide this information for DOE to use?
For DOE and the public, really. Everything that we do is publicly funded, and so we try to get as much of that data out there as in the public domain as possible, especially for the resource work that I do. It's really the motivation is to get it out there into the public domain. And we have several ways that we do that. We have, we recently just launched a new tool, the Marine Energy Atlas, and there's a webinar that you can find online about how to access that data at NREL. So basically the Marine Energy Atlas hosts and provides to the public all of the different resource types, so wave energy, tidal energy, ocean current energy, and so you can go in there and you can look at the maps, you can find the hot spots for different resource types, and you can also download data if that's something you're interested in.
So how long have you been in this role? Because the stuff we're talking about, of course, is in a lot of ways very new and or constantly developing, and a lot of technologies that are kind of in flux.
So I joined NREL about 10 years ago, and I came from a PhD in physical oceanography. And so when I joined NREL, they were really interested in understanding ocean turbulence. The marine energy program at that time was really new. The technology for marine energy is still very new, even now. And so when they hired me, it was really my background in ocean turbulence, which is what I did my PhD on, that they were interested in. And they wanted to understand ocean turbulence because in the wind energy industry, turbulence in the atmosphere, they found, was a key driver of the loads on wind turbines that basically caused them to fail. And it was a big engineering challenge throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s, basically figuring out that we've really got to account for atmospheric turbulence in our wind turbine designs in terms of making them robust enough to survive in the turbulent atmospheric conditions, basically. And so they knew that from wind energy from the wind energy industry, and so they wanted to be sort of ahead of the game in the early days of the tidal energy industry in terms of accounting for turbulence. And so that's really what brought me in. And as time went on, you know, at that time we were a really small team at NREL. It was really new for marine energy. There was about like six of us, and so, you know, as time went on, my role grew and I kind of grew into this role of leading the resource characterization work for the Department of Energy.
Before we kind of talk more about specifics and about Cook Inlet, I guess something that might be good to actually kind of define is, what is tidal energy? Very basic question, or marine energy generally, if that feels like an important characterization as well.
Yeah, marine energy, in the way that Department of Energy and the U.S. government defines it, includes pretty much any energy source that we can identify that is in the ocean or in rivers. So in marine energy, we also include energy that we can harvest from free-flowing rivers. So it's sort of like hydropower, but without a dam. And then in addition to sort of that riverine energy, we also include tidal energy, ocean current energy, ocean thermal energy, wave energy, and there's a few others as well. So part of what I do is I try to quantify each of those different resource types. For tidal energy specifically, you know, I often tell people that the technology is essentially underwater wind turbines. And people often will say, well, that sounds simple enough. We've got those, right? Like that's all figured out. And I'm like, well, do you remember the part where I said it was underwater? And I think people in Alaska get it, right? Like in Colorado, I probably get asked that question more often than I do up here. The ocean is a very challenging environment. But it's also really exciting. It's an exciting time to be in this industry.
So, of course, you're here kind of to talk about Cook Inlet. And so when did Cook Inlet come onto your radar as a source? I know you grew up in the area, so I'm sure Cook Inlet has always been on your radar in a general sense. But when did you kind of start having an awareness of its energy potential?
So the first time I thought about tidal energy, I'd have to go all the way back to my childhood. I grew up as my dad's right hand, and he's kind of a frenetic guy, he's always looking for the next big challenge. One day I'd be helping him fix fences. The next day we'd be repairing tractors or haying fields. He was a machinist by trade, and so he'd be, you know, fixing somebody's propeller shaft, clearing stumps from fields and meadows, and he also owns a freight business that ships freight all around the bay. And so it was probably on one of those trips with him, I was deckhanding, driving across the inlet. And we started talking about the large tides, right? Anyone who spends time on the water here is aware of the large tidal amplitudes that we have. And so we started talking about, wouldn't it be cool if we could figure out how to, you know, harness some energy from these tides? And at the time, the kind of concept that we were throwing around was like a big, basically platform where you would maybe connect a cable that had a pulley on the bottom of the seafloor, and then it went back to shore, and as the tides went up and down, it like pulled a generator. As I've learned now, actually, that kind of like tidal amplitude, what is what I would call that, the tides going up and down, is not really the most technically feasible way to harness tidal energy as far as we know so far. And what we look at instead is locations that have really strong tidal currents. And so we look for sites where the tidal flow is pinched by the geography, and the flow, you know, the flow accelerates to basically squeeze through that tight spot. And the Forelands here, just outside our door,
in Nikiski,
yeah, are one of those locations. And so you combine that really high tidal amplitudes that we have in this area with that pinch point, and it ends up being one of the most, it's the number one tidal energy site in the country right here in Nikiski.
I think that's just an extraordinary statement that we have that right down the street. It's really remarkable. Yeah. And I know you're going to do some research on that site, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a bit. But can you talk a little bit kind of about some of the other places you've looked at up to this point, or some of the research you've done? How do you quantify tidal and marine energy? That seems like a tall order.
Yeah, so we've done work, a lot of the work that I've done, I really want to give a shout out to my collaborators at University of Washington Applied Physics Lab. Jim Thompson and his group really helped me get started in this space. And we developed a system for, we put a buoy down that's a submerged buoy. So it actually flies at about the middle of the water column, and it's got a bunch of sensors on there to measure the currents, and we measure temperature and salinity and a bunch of other different variables. But getting those measurements right in the middle of the water column where we expect tidal turbines to be placed was really a key sort of challenge that we wanted to tackle. And so that team at University of Washington was really helpful in us in figuring that out. And so we made a bunch of those preliminary measurements in Puget Sound, all throughout Puget Sound. We've also done some work making similar measurements in the Western Passage of Maine. It's actually, it's outside of Eastport, Maine. It's like the most, it's the easternmost point in the continental U.S., I'm pretty sure. And it's right adjacent to what they call the Western Passage, which is a little bit counterintuitive. But that's also a really excellent site for tidal energy as well.
Kind of diametrically on the other side of the...
Exactly, on the other side of the country, yeah.
So you put the buoy down.
Yeah.
Then what?
So there's really two main variables that we're trying to measure this summer. So we're putting three moorings in the water just offshore of the East Foreland. There's a channel there that we expect to be a really energetic tidal site. And the main things we're trying to measure are the velocity and the turbulence. And we do that with these instruments that are called acoustic Doppler current profilers. They're totally amazing instruments, in my opinion. I could nerd out about them for days. but they send out acoustic pings, and that ping echoes off of particles in the water column, and then it listens for the echo. And the shift in the frequency, the shift in the tone of the echo, then gives us a measurement of the velocity. And the cool thing
is that's crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
What an interesting technology.
Yeah, so it's the Doppler effect is basically the physical effect that we're leveraging there. But the really amazing thing about these instruments is they send that ping out, and then they sort of listen at different points in time, and that lag is different locations in the water column. So you actually get a profile throughout the water column of the velocity from this one instrument.
So you can kind of tell where vertically would be the best place to put these turbines.
Yeah, you can measure the velocity vertically throughout the water column with these instruments. And we use these moorings that are positioned at the middle of the water column because we want to have those really precise measurements of the turbulence is the other thing that we want to be measuring, or we're going to be measuring. And so having those instruments right there in the middle of the water column gives us that precise measurement of velocity. The other advantage of having these moorings at the middle of the water column is you sort of avoid a lot of the risks of like boulders or getting buried by sand or those sorts of things of having the mooring on the bottom.
More free flowing.
Yeah, you just mitigate the risk of damage to your system, basically.
So you've mentioned turbulence a bit. How does turbulence of the water play into all of this? What does that contribute to the equation?
Yeah. So most people's, you know, when they hear the word turbulence, they think of airplane flights and the discomfort associated with
not a positive connotation.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, in the same way that airplanes are designed to handle turbulence. The wind industry basically had to figure out that wind turbines really needed to account for turbulence. And so we're doing the same thing for tidal energy. It's really about making the technologies robust enough to survive in that very turbulent environment, and having an accurate understanding of what those turbulence levels are is really critical to the engineering process, because you want to make your technologies as sort of light and sleek and low cost as possible. But if you go too far on that, then they're going to break. And so finding that sweet spot of making them just strong enough to survive, the expected lifetime, 20, maybe 30 years that you plan for them to, without having to, dump excess resources into the technology it's a really critical thing to figure out.
So to give people kind of the visual, when we're talking about putting these turbines in, these durable yet sleek turbines into the water, is it a line of turbines? Is it one singular turbine? What does kind of the magnitude of the technology look like in this area? Or what should it look like? Because obviously it doesn't exist there yet.
Yeah. So I just want to, be really clear that tidal energy technologies are at a very early stage. And the costs of the technology compared to wind or compared to, other sources of energy is still very high. Realistically, we're probably 10 years or more away from seeing large-scale deployments of tidal arrays. So it would be, in the long term, it would probably be, if you could look underwater, it wouldn't look too different from a wind farm that you're sort of familiar with, where there's a bunch of different turbines, and then they pivot probably around to harness energy when the water's flowing in different directions. That's the basic idea of what the technology would look like someday. But in the near term, I think what we're talking about is a lot of R&D still needs to happen for these technologies. The U.S., it's really exciting time right now in this industry, because there's a bunch of different companies that are starting to get real successes with their technology. In the U.S., Verdant Power has had a really successful project in the East River in New York City. Ocean Renewable Power Company has had a lot of success right here in Alaska, in Igiagig, Alaska, as a small village on Lake Iliamna. And that project has also been really successful. And so those are a couple of U.S. companies that are starting to have some promising results with technologies. And then in Europe, they've also been doing similar types of demonstration projects. And they're actually a little bit ahead of us in terms of the scale of the technology. Their devices are quite a bit bigger. But I'd say we're catching up fast. They basically have put more money into the technology, and so they're a little bit ahead.
So the projects you mentioned, East River and Igiagig, those are river projects.
Yes.
So have there been any ocean tidal power projects that have...
So, well, let's back up, actually. The Igiagig project, yes, is a river project, but the Verdant Power project it's on the East River, but the East River is actually it's in the ocean. It's a tidally forced channel that connects Long Island Sound to the New York Harbor, basically. So it is tidally forced. It's salt water. The tides oscillate back and forth.
It has some of the power of an ocean.
The power of an ocean, yeah, and it oscillates back and forth each tidal cycle, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So I know something that a lot of people, I have a map of New York pulled up now, and I'm looking at it. I know something a lot of people have brought up is the challenge that comes with, putting something like this in an ocean just because of the turbidity or turbulence.
I'm trying
to be fancy with my words here, of the ocean. So does that project in the East River give us at all kind of a flavor of what some of those challenges might be?
Definitely. I mean, I think, you know, so many Alaskans are going to be familiar with how harsh of environment the ocean is. You know, salt water alone is you know, very corrosive and difficult to work with. And, you know, in Cook Inlet in particular, you know, it's salt water. It's also fed by many glacial rivers. And so there's a lot of sediment in the inlet. And that's actually another variable that we're going to be measuring this summer. We're using optical instruments, basically, to measure kind of the size and volume and mass of the sediments in the water. And then that's going to be really critical, I think, for designing things like seals and bearings for these technologies so that we can really make sure we get the lifetime out of devices that we need.
Interesting. So kind of going back to this project that you're doing this summer.
Yeah.
So when are you doing this research and kind of why now?
We're going to be making these resource measurements offshore of the East Foreland. We're going to be just about within about a nautical mile of the tip of the East Foreland. We're putting three moorings in the water. One of them is going to be sitting on the seafloor, and two others are these mid-water moorings that I talked about a little bit. And we're putting them in the water at the end of June, and they'll be in the water for 2 months, and then we'll go back out and recover them.
When after that are you going to kind of have your data? How long does that data take how long does it take to sift through that information? And is it you who's going to be kind of doing that work?
I'll be doing some of the initial data processing. We're hoping to have the data public within 6 months.
Oh, cool.
It does take quite a bit of time to process the data. So one of the challenges of having these midwater moorings where you have velocity measurements on a buoy is that buoy's moving around. And so if you're making velocity measurements from a moving platform, the motion of that platform is in your measurements. So one of the things that this was actually a part of some of my early work at NREL was we basically have motion sensors on board the instruments, basically the exact same thing that's in your phone, so that it knows its orientation and when you shake it or those sorts of things. And so we take the measurements from those, or the signals from those motion sensors, and we use that to calculate the motion of the platform itself. And then we subtract that motion from the measurements that the velocity sensors are making to get sort of a measurement of the velocity in the Earth reference frame.
Wow.
And that takes some time.
Like a pedometer, it sounds like.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to break it down.
Yeah. Yeah. A very complex pedometer.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the reason we're doing this now is to try to get ahead of the game in terms of we're at a point where we're starting to see some of these technologies really demonstrate the levels of reliability that I think we are going to expect. And, you know, we're not quite there yet in terms of the scale of the devices and the reliability. You know, we want these devices to be able to survive in a harsh environment like Cook Inlet for 20 plus years. And we've only been, you know, testing them for maybe three years. But now that we're starting to get those tests that are showing the devices can work for a year or more, and we're building up that data set, we're going to start to get to the point where we're like, okay, we want to start testing these devices in the harshest environments. So by making these measurements this summer, we're basically collecting that data that says this is what the size of the devices are going to be best for this site. These are some of the challenges that you're going to see, like sediments and ice. And these are the strength of the currents. This is the intensity of, this is how intense the turbulence is. And then project developers can start to, and technology developers can take that data and start developing technologies that match those needs. And so that's really why we're getting started now. But it's just such an exciting time to be involved in renewable energy, because it does feel like we're at this transition point. And at NREL, NREL is really starting to take a big turn In terms of its role in Alaska, we just a little over a year ago, we merged with the Cold Climate Housing Research Center, which is a research center based in Fairbanks that has been doing a lot of amazing work on how to build, you know, build for cold climates. And they work with a lot of rural communities around the state, building homes that both meet the cultural sort of expectations of the communities, as well as the sort of energy needs and really well insulated for those environments. Like I said, they joined NREL a year ago. I remember when I first heard about it because I'd seen presentations by some of the leaders of CCHRC when I first joined NREL, and I remember being really impressed with the work they did. They have a really big focus on the community and really listening first to what the needs of the community are. And so when I heard that NREL was merging with CCHRC and forming this partnership, I was like, wow, that is a big win for NREL. And I think, you know, as time has gone on, I think some of the people within NREL have started to realize how valuable CCHRC is. And so it's exciting to know that I'm going to have co-NRELians, as we call ourselves, in the state. I'm excited to be working with those guys. And, you know, I think the thing that we're excited about within NREL is, you know, CCHRC has been, you know, at the forefront of the demand side, sort of trying to manage how much energy is used in the community and reduce that through building design. And then the rest of NREL has a lot of our focus. We do have other, you know, we have buildings group, but a lot of the lab is focused on the supply side. How do we make more energy or make it cheaper, make devices more efficient and technologies more efficient? And so I think by joining CCHRC with NREL, we're going to be able to find those solutions that meet the needs across on both the supply and demand side of the energy equation in these cold climates. And so it's just a really exciting time to be in Alaska doing work in renewable energy and renewable technologies.